any tidbit he could feed us about whether Led Zeppelin would get back together was especially important, because you're not going to be able to get it over the web. Same thing when I interviewed Don Henley, get to talk about, you know, will the Eagles get back together? What's the status of the band right now? This was pre-internet, so it made these interviews, I'd say it gave them an added importance.
Hey, Daddy-O. The voice of Bobby Scafish, longtime DJ, a legendary DJ in Chicago. Welcome to Rock Conversations. I'm Rob Bob, and thanks for joining us. Remember, if you would please, to give us a review. You can listen to us, obviously, on Apple, Spotify, Audible, wherever you get your podcast. And if you like what you hear, give us a nice review. And if you don't like what you hear, you can give us whatever review you want. Bobby Scafish has spent years, he's been out of the biz for a while, but he spent years in radio in Chicago, working originally at WXRT from 6 to 10, and then he switched over to The Loop, and then back to XRT with, I think, a stint at Q101 in between that, and then wrapped up what was probably the last gig of his career, at least according to him, at The Drive, where he did Afternoon Drive on 97.1. Boy, I started listening to him in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, shortly after he moved over to The Loop from WXRT. And it was, what a lineup. I mean, they had Stroud. Well, they had Jonathan Brandmeier, Johnny B in the morning. Bob Stroud did middays, very music intense, obviously. Then they went back to some talk with Steve and Gary, Steve Dahl and Gary Meyer. And then Bobby Scafish did evenings. And then when they got an AM frequency, they moved Steve and Gary to the AM and put Scafish in Afternoon Drive. So can you imagine that, going Bob Stroud to Bobby Scafish back to back? Oh, what a lineup. And it was a great time with the music they played, a blend of what we now call classic rock, as well as new music, mostly by established artists, but they would break an artist here and there. And it was just a great time to listen to the radio. Now, this conversation you're about to hear with Bobby Scafish was obviously recorded before the 2021 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees were announced, because we talk about Todd Rundgren. The first chapter of Bobby's book deals with Todd Rundgren. Bobby's book is called We Have Company, and it's an excellent read. But Todd Rundgren was up once again in 2021 for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he got in. But you can tell we're reflecting on whether he wanted to be part of it, whether the hall thought he was politically correct enough to be part of it. You take your pick on how you wanted to describe it. But I did want to point that out. And the other thing I'll just note with Rock Conversations is that we do our best to get the best audio possible via Zoom. Sometimes there might be just a little challenge or two. And dare I say, this is one of those times. So, you know, it's Bobby Scafish. If the audio isn't perfect, deal with it. Bobby is, well, maybe not perfect, but real close to it in my mind. So let's get to it. Our rock conversation with Bobby Scafish.
Oh, let's go back. Let's go back. Let's go back again.
Let me start and just admit up front that I started listening to you in the mid 80s when you were at The Loop, and I am a big fan. So hopefully I don't come across as too much like Chris Farley, you know, stupid.
Okay.
So, but you know, the mid 80s, mid to late 80s, maybe it was because of my age, maybe it was because of the music. It was like the halcyon days of rock and roll radio, I thought. And I would like to hear you describe what it was like to work at The Loop during that period of time.
You know, it was a very exciting time. And, it was exciting because the station was successful, which put everyone in a better mood. And also, there was a real camaraderie, I think, more than any place I've ever worked. I think the time at The Loop from 83 to 93 that I was there, the camaraderie was really good, really high.
There was such a, it was like a combination as a listener. There was kind of that swagger, that attitude. And then you backed it up, not just with the personalities, But with the music, it wasn't just what we call today classic rock. I mean, you were playing a lot of new music back then.
That's right. Absolutely.
And yeah. Let's talk about some of the interviews you did, not just at The Loop, but elsewhere. Your book is We Have Company. I love the way you started the book, chapter number one, with one of my favorites, Todd Rundgren.
Yeah.
Why did you start with him? I mean, he's known to a lot of rock and roll fans, respected by so many. But to the average public, when I bring up Todd Rundgren's name, they're like, who? I have to sing a couple bars of, you know, Hello, It's Me. Why'd you start with him?
Well, the book was chronological. That's why. And I met Todd when I was the very first time I encountered him, I think I was a freshman in college, or it was after my senior year, but before I started college. It was before I got into professional radio, for sure.
He's such a great talent. You have an interesting story in the book, how you got to attend, shall we say, a show of his in Chicago. I think you could pick up the story, but I think you and a buddy kind of worked your way through the side door, if you will.
Yeah, we were underage, and we waited on the street, and through a supreme stroke of luck, Todd came walking up. We explained our plight, that we were too young to get in, but we wanted to get in and if possible talk to him. He said, go around back. We did. He let us in the back door and was kinder than he needed to be in giving us a long conversation with him.
He's doing kind of a cool thing right now where he's doing this kind of virtual tour originating from Chicago, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I wonder, have you checked it out yet? I think I'm going to check out, well, it would only be fitting if I checked out the date when he comes to the Twin Cities here in Minnesota. Are you going to check out one of the shows?
I don't know, but my understanding is he sort of, he tailors it to the city he's in.
Yeah. With kind of the, you know, banter in between songs. And I think some photos and videos too. So it's you know, leave it to him to come up with an interesting comment. And I won't dwell on Todd too long, but I was talking with Barney Hoskins the other day, who incidentally reference in your book. And we were talking about Rundgren, and he thinks that Todd, number one, is one of the brightest musicians he's ever listened to and or dealt with. But he thinks that maybe he's a little too smug for his own good, and maybe that's why he's not yet in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Do you buy into that at all?
Well, he has definitely said he doesn't care. And there's a school of thought that says he doesn't suck up or kiss up to maybe the people he should, which would maybe make him a less likely candidate. I mean, the guy goes his own way. He marches to his own different drummer. So, you know, he's not typical in any way. So I'm sure that hasn't helped his chances.
We are talking to Bobby Skafish, a Chicago radio legend, 40 some years in the business. In 1987, I was a senior in high school in Winona, Minnesota. And I was working at one of the college radio stations, KQAL, at Winona State University. And they had a lot of Chicago, what I would call Chicago transplants, or FIBs, as we sometimes called them. and Mary Sloan called me one night at my, you know, I was living with my parents, obviously, as a high school senior. And she knew of a certain interest I had in a certain radio station in Chicago. She said, Rob, you got to turn on the local station. Bobby Skafish is emceeing the Pretenders show.
Sure enough,
National. It was a UIC, right?
At the Pavilion. UIC Pavilion, yeah.
Yeah, what was that like?
Oh, it's tremendous. While I was at The Loop, I got to host, I think, three national shows. One was a call-in show with Robert Plant as a guest about a week after I got there. And then the second was The Pretenders. The opening act was Iggy Pop at the UIC Pavilion. It was you know, basically a straight concert thing where I hosted the event on the radio. And then the third was I hosted Rockline in the absence of Bob Coburn. We did it from Chicago with Styx. But national broadcasts were just so thrilling for the very reason you just brought up, that here you're sitting in Minnesota and you could hear me. It meant a lot to me.
And, you know, the obvious for people our age is this was long before internet radio, anything related to the internet, you know. So if we could get something on a local station that was being simulcast, it was super cool. One thing I didn't even consider until I was reading your book is that, you know, you had to ad lib a bit, not knowing exactly when the Pretenders were going to take the stage. Isn't that right?
Yeah. That's the, you know, that's the thrill of live radio. You know, it's just that it's not scripted. Anything can happen. You got to be ready for it.
We're talking with Bobby Scafish. You were working at XRT, if I'm not mistaken, the night John Lennon was killed.
Yeah.
And you were in the midst of a sponsored show. Was it the Big Beat or something else where you couldn't really get out of it and you had to kind of bring the news to people, but you couldn't really do the tribute? That had to be quite a quandary.
Yeah.
You know, you got the emotion that goes with the news and then you want to share it. But, you know, how did you go about that?
Well, the show was actually called This Week in Chicago. And we did it every Monday night from 9 till 10, 2 p.m. I was the host. It was sponsored, as you say. And it had to do with musicians who were coming to Chicago to play concerts at, you know, the Aragon or nightclubs or whatever. And during the course of the show, the latter part of the show, it came over in two stages. First, there was a news bulletin that Lennon had been shot. And not too long after, another news bulletin saying he had died. So I was able to break the news, but in my mind, I shouldn't break format and play Lennon music because we were still doing something specifically that was not that.
And in a roundabout twist, if you will, and you recount this in your book, you and I think Bob Stroud together interviewed Julian Lennon years later. What was he like? I mean, you wonder sometimes, you look at these sons of legends, tough shoes to fill. Was he down to earth?
No. Extremely so. And accommodating. He was fine when we would talk about his dad or asking questions about his dad. I think through the course of his life, just reading up on him, he's gone through different phases where there have been times where he's done press and talked about what a absent father that is John Lennon was, but he was not in that phase at the time. And he was feeling good and he was a very sweet guy.
Bobby Scafish is our guest, legendary rock and roll DJ in Chicago, worked at The Loop, XRT, The Drive. In the course of those years, you did not just a lot of interviews. Sometimes you would, not from the studio for that matter, but you would go on scene. I remember listening back in the day when you somewhat regularly went to Poplar Creek and did interviews from out there.
Yeah.
That was always cool. Did you enjoy it or was it a pain in the butt leaving, you know, the city and getting out to somewhere like Poplar Creek or Tinley Park, wherever it might be?
No, Poplar Creek was great. We had like our own little crew. We had an engineer and someone from the promotions department, maybe an intern while we're at it. And it was a great venue. And we'd get out there about 2 hours before they even opened the gates and did our thing. And sometimes one of the artists would come by to talk a little. That would be fantastic, too. And no, we enjoyed it. It was a good change of scenery.
I don't want to revert and dwell on alcohol, but Jimmy Page apparently came with the goods when he came to The Loop to be interviewed. I think it was The Loop. What was it? 1.7 of vodka?
It was, I don't know liter size what it would be, but it was a large bottle of vodka where it had like the built-in handle, you know, that you could stick your finger in to pour it. He was making these atomic strength screwdrivers, which maybe had a thimble full of orange juice and the rest vodka.
Sounds like a good Zeppelin move.
He's another one. He's straightened out since then. He lives
clean.
Was he
a good interview?
He was good. It's a funny thing. I mean, that was another pre-internet situation where any tidbit he could feed us about whether Led Zeppelin would get back together was especially important because you're not going to be able to get it over the web. So that's why, same thing when I interviewed Don Henley, get to talk about, you know, will the Eagles get back together? What's the status of the band right now? This was pre-internet, so it made these interviews, I'd say it gave them an added importance.
I'm curious as not only a DJ, but a music fan, as you look back over the years, was there a reunion of sorts, whether it's the Eagles, Zeppelin's short reunions, that you really thought went well? And was there conversely something where you thought, yeah, maybe you should have stayed broken up?
I was happy about the Eagles reformation because I was a fan and I never got to see him the first time around, but I did get to see him in concert the second time around. So that was, I thought that was good. As for failed reunions, none spring to mind. And yeah. Can you think of some?
I like the Eagles. I had not seen them. I saw them on the Hell Freezes Over tour.
Yeah.
I thought it was really good. I thought Joe Walsh stole the show. I mean, the rest of the band I thought was really good. The rumor I heard early on is that it wasn't just Glenn Frey's physical health, supposedly. It was that they got into the rehearsal mode and thought, Joe Walsh is kicking our butt out here. We got to postpone this tour and get back into the groove, whether that's true or not. I don't think I have any failed reunions. I was so excited to see Zeppelin play the buildup at Live Aid. I wasn't too happy with the performance that night.
Yeah, they weren't either, for that matter.
It's tough. You're brought together, in kind of a rush situation, I guess. It's still cool to see the old guys get back together, right?
Yeah, sure.
I hear, according again, I keep referring to your book. We Have Company is the book by Bobby Scafish. And one of the things I love about it is not just the Q&A, there it is. Yes. For those of us who are looking on video, it's great. You do a great job of really setting up the interviews, whether it's talking about your first influence or experience with the band, listening to them, whether it's, painting a picture of the studios. When I interviewed you for my wine publication, it was at, was it called the Bunker on Belmont? Is that what you affectionately refer to as?
I called it the Pleasure Dome, okay. But some people called it that. Yeah.
Because let's just say it was, it reminded me of this one station in Winona, Minnesota, where I worked. That station was an old house, and when you walk, the floors creaked. I'm not sure XRT was quite that on Belmont, but nonetheless, I digress. We're talking about the book and how you set it up so well. So it's not just a Q&A. You're really painting a picture, and then you, in most of the chapters, have some of the quotes verbatim. And the give and take, I always find it kind of ironic, maybe, that, your lines are always slugged BS.
Good one. I felt it was important to give the interview some context, where the artist was at that point in their career. Was it just the beginning? Were they hot? Had they already peaked? I thought it was important to give it some context.
So what I wanted to get there, and I went off on my own tangent, my apologies, is that apparently you do a pretty good impersonation of Ray Manzarek. Is that right? Do we get to hear some of it?
I'm going to pass right now.
Okay.
I feel like I'm a little past my prime on my Ray. I think in the 90s is when I was doing it better.
Ray might be past his prime on his Ray, right?
Amen to that, yeah.
But what a great band. Yeah.
It was a thrill to interview Ray Manzarek because Chicago native, I was a huge Doors fan. And, to the point that I imitated Ray, that I had heard so many interviews with him, that that's one I didn't want to blow. I really wanted to get right. And lo and behold, he brings this poet, Michael McClure, with him. And if you're not a fan of poetry, you may not even know who the guy is, but he was considered a pretty big deal in poetry circles. And I had to sort of adapt on the fly and ask him some questions and draw him into the conversation as well.
Now, I'll preface this next question by saying, please don't say this one, but have you ever had a dud of an interview?
I would say there were maybe a few people who were not as happy to be there as I would have liked. I think Nancy Wilson from Heart had already gone through a day where she had done a whole series of these interviews downtown and was going to do a concert later that night. And then they had to truck out all the way to Belmont and Cicero at this not extremely high rated station. I think she was a little, maybe a little less enthusiastic than I might've liked, but that's okay. I understand the concept there, what was going on.
Well, it's probably tough. You give a shout out to Jacob Slichter from Semisonic.
Oh yeah.
And he basically says, we're kind of this cog in a machine, and you just kind of, I don't want to say going through the motions, but their job is to do a lot of these interviews and musicians. The other interesting thing you pointed out, I think it was Lindsey Buckingham, who, when he maybe got tired of talking, started strumming his guitar as if to say, let's do a tune. I'm done talking. All right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in my early days, maybe during the point when I was actually doing these, I didn't have the perspective that I have now. I thought they loomed a little larger in the artist's mind, then, you know, I read the book by the guy from Semisonic, and you learn it's sort of a grind, and they're doing a lot of these in one day, and maybe they start to blend a little bit.
We're talking with Bobby Skafish, a longtime DJ in Chicago, The Loop, XRT, couple stints at XRT, The Drive, and let's not forget, mornings at Q101, right?
Yeah.
You grew up in Hammond, Indiana. My grandparents, my mom and her brother grew up in Whiting, so not too far.
Ah, like so city, you know, north, basically. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. You mentioned Hegwisch Records in the book, and God, I love that place. And was Woodmar Records open when you were living there?
Absolutely. I knew the people who managed the place, and Woodmar Shopping Center.
Yeah, you know, coming from a smaller town in Minnesota, whenever we went to, you know, for those of you unfamiliar with this is Northwest Indiana, basically just across the border from Chicago. You know, the record prices were about a buck or two cheaper than they were in Winona, Minnesota, and the selection was much better. So, you know, I would go, I'd buy, and sometimes if my mom visited her parents on her own, I'd send her with a list. I said, Mom, can you, when you're at Carson Peary Scott, do you think you could walk down the hallway down to Woodmar Records and get me, you know, a couple of these? And so it worked out well. The great days of record stores. I try to impart, and I think somewhat successfully, to my two sons who are in their 20s now, the value of vinyl and what it meant to actually go to a store and experience it. What memories do you have that really stick out from your years, not just growing up, but, you know, your earlier years in radio in Chicago, where you had places like Rose Records and others?
Well, you know, for me, a big one was Hegwisch Records before they moved to Calumet City, when they were actually in Hegwisch. That was the first store I ever encountered that was just like a huge barn packed solid with vinyl and cassettes too. And some pretty knowledgeable dudes behind the counter. And it was like you found the mother lode when you would go there. And so I spent a lot of time and spent a lot of money there. I still remember some of the things I bought there, Deep Purple, Fireball, John Lennon, Imagine, Graham Nash, Songs for Beginners.
I bought John Lennon's Imagine there, I think, at the one in Calumet City, not at the one in actually in Hegwisch.
I was probably living in Chicago or so by the time that they... I mean, I had gone to that store, but not as frequently. My biggest memories are the original one in Hegwisch.
In the few minutes we have left, by the way, we're talking with Bobby Skafish, a longtime DJ in Chicago and the author of We Have Company. An excellent read. Your former coworker, Bob Stroud, I think in one of the blurbs said, you know, set aside a day because it's going to take you that or less than a day to read it. It took me two only because I started at midday, but it is a fantastic read. And it's very quick. And full of great stories. Let's talk about Robbie Robertson. In fact, I got to ask you this. I don't mean to seem like, you know, I spend all my time listening to radio, but I was listening at the gym yesterday to XRT, and Frankie Lee does weekends now occasionally. And he was talking about an interview that had been done on XRT with Robbie Robertson. So immediately I thought of you. Is that where you were when you did it, or were you at the Loop?
Yeah. Okay. No, it was at XRT. And some of the ones that meant the most to me were the ones where I had spent my own money on their records or concert tickets. And the band who he wrote all the songs for was definitely one of those kind of acts. To interview a guy like that I had been a huge fan of, and I had bought The Last Waltz and seen it 1,000 times on video. Those are the ones that meant the most to me. And David Bowie springs to mind. I bought his records, gone to his concerts. Brian Ferry from Roxy Music. That was really a kick for me to interview guys that had been my heroes not too many years before.
Now, there is a chance, I suppose, that Robertson did two interviews over the course of the years at XRT, but Frankie Lee said he thought Tom Marker did the interview. And I'm thinking, I don't want to correct you here, but, you know, it's kind of like a Larry David. I don't know, but
I don't know if Tom did or not.
Yeah. You know, I remember listening to you on The Loop when you were playing some of Robbie Robertson's solo stuff, you know, Showdown at Big Sky and what is it? Sweet Fire of Love. Where he, I mean, what an album and what a backing. What's the word? Just a smorgasbord of backing musicians from the U2 to the Bodines. You probably remember that album well.
guys from the Bodines, guys from U2, and even a few guys from the band helped him out. Yeah, I have fond memories of that album, absolutely.
In the few minutes we have left, let's talk about one of your fellow Hoosiers, John Mellencamp. He always seemed to have such a unique relationship with the Loop. Is it because you kind of, as a station, I don't want to say you broke him, meaning, you know, were the first to play him, but you sort of, maybe you were, but you surely played him regularly. You had Loop custom cuts on at least one of his songs. Was he a good dude to talk to?
He was a very good dude to talk to. He did something that I don't remember anyone else before or since doing. When the interview was over, normally the artist just hangs up the phone, boom, he's gone. He hung on the line. I started the record up. I come back to him and he thanked me. And that's rare. So that he'll always have a special place in my life for that.
And obviously he was, you know, a big driving force behind Farm Aid, which, know, that he spoke to so vividly on Scarecrow. And then, you know, to be able to do, really to put your money where your mouth is or your talent where your mouth is. I still laud people like him who, you know, and Geldof, you know, with Live Aid or, you know, Band Aid, and said, you know, how many people sit at home and see something on the news and say, what can I do to make it better? Especially in this day and age where we're, you know, constantly bitching about things, and I'm guilty from time to time. But to see these musicians, you know, say, okay, I could do something different. And, you know, I think a lot of people, as you noted, criticized, Do They Know It's Christmas? Big deal, right? I thought it was kind of good tune, and I, you know, I thought the effort was spectacular.
I agree on both counts. So I don't get it. It's a different era now. I think people are snarkier. You know, that's just sort of the way it is from even back then when that record came out.
So in the waning minutes here, I don't want to sound like we're both old geezers, but let's wax poetically for a second or two. Where did radio, rock radio in particular, go wrong?
Oh, boy. You know, I try not to be one of these guys who's out of the business and then just sits and criticizes, because I took the money for all those years and I participated eagerly. But I think it's run more by business people than it is by people with an artistic bent, the way it used to be. I think now it's just another bottom line oriented business, and they want to get maximum profits from the smallest amount of, you know, output of dollars that they could pump into it. That's why a lot of, it's rare to hear a live overnight show nowadays. Right. They just, you don't get that. They figured, why pay someone when people, there's not many people listening. So smaller audience. So they just run a series of, you know, IDs or something in between the records. Don't even bother with a DJ. So I think it's more bottom line, more money oriented.
Yeah, it's frustrating, and I get the business side as a small businessman myself, but I also I rue the fact that we're not really, you know, with the exception of stations like XRT, seeing, you know, kind of that mojo, the new music, the willingness to try something a little different. We're all I said we weren't going to wax poetically like old men, so I won't. Let's end on something really positive. What's left for you? I mean, do you have anything in the tank where you want to do some radio one more time?
I doubt it.
Okay.
Doubt it. I'll be doing radio again. It's a kick for me. My 17-year-old daughter does online radio, so I critique her a little bit. That's about as close as I am to the business right now.
Well, she's got a great teacher, huh?
She's a natural. She's good.
The book. Let's give it one more plug at least, right? We Have Company. Mm-hmm. By Bobby Skafish, longtime DJ. The book is great. And I was telling my wife today, I said, you know, I think it came out, what, about 5-6 years ago, but it's really timeless for rock and roll fans because, you know, you're writing about the past, and those incidents, those interviews, those stories aren't going to change. So it's a great read for people who either love rock and roll and or love radio.
Rob, that's a really good perception, because it does have an unlimited shelf life in that way. It's about things that already have happened. So there's no need to, you know, add a bonus new chapter to update it. It's fine just the way it is.
Bobby Skafish, great to talk to you, and thanks for taking time.
Likewise. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Good job.